From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Welcome to part two of the Bruce Wirtz story, and a singer-songwriter called Jerry Lorden is the subject of our first conversation in part two.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to John Hannam Moots.
Meeting Jerry Lorden on a tour, well, changed your life again. Yes.
Hey, yeah. That's not bad for a lad from Newcastle,
very
is it?
Good, very impressed. Because I don't care wherever you are, when you hear Apache, people of a certain age, it's fantastic, you know. And I know there was another record by Mr. Whedon, but when yours came on the scene, it just...
Well, I can tell you the story very quickly. On, we were on tour, Cliff and the Shades were on tour in April of 1960. And one of the support acts was a guy called Jerry Lorden, who was a singer-songwriter.
I've got his albums. I love it.
Yeah, he'd had a couple of small hits, I'll Stay Single, and Who Could Be Bluer.
That's it. I love that
one. He was in the top 10 with Who Could Be Bluer.
Yeah.
So he was a singer-songwriter. We always used to travel together on a coach in those days. Everybody was on a coach, guitars and everything on it. And Norrie Paramore was our producer. And it was the way it was then. You released a record every 3 months. And... we had had The Shadows, I'm talking about now. We'd had Feeling Fine, vocal, Jet Black, instrumental, and Saturday Dance, which got to number 30. So not hits. And we're all talking, and I said, we were talking to Jerry. I said, oh, we need a new single, you know, soon, like July-ish, we need a single. And he said, can I play you a tune? I've got a tune I've written, you know. So we all said, yeah. So he went to the back of the bus, and he brought out a big ukulele. He used to write and play on a ukulele, but a big one. And he played the rhythm, and he just went down, 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 down. And Hank and I went, oh, yeah, we'd like that. We'd like to play that to Norrie, you know, because Norrie Paramore was obviously the boss. So we went to Norrie and said, we've got this great tune we've heard, Norrie. And he said, well, I've chosen your next A-side, because he was the producer, so he told us what to do, not... And he said, but you could... he said, your next A-side is going to be Quartermaster Stores, the old army song. You know, da-da-down, down, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da. And so he said, but you can do Apache as the B-side, the other side. So we recorded the two tracks in June of 1960. And Apache then was a brand new sound. Hank with the Stratocaster, but the Echo Box, the sound of the Echo Box, the Vox amp. I was on acoustic, big acoustic guitar. And we just knew, we liked both the records, but we said to Norrie, Apache's better than Quartermaster Stores. He said, no. He said, I really like Quartermaster Stores. And we said, oh, please, Norrie, it's just different. It's so different. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take it home to my daughters and play it to them and see what they think. And he took it home and they chose Apache. And they had done it once before. A young guy called Cliff Richard, when he made Move It, Move It was going to be the B-side. Norrie took it home to his daughters and the daughters chose Move It.
Wow.
So... thank you, Norrie's daughters. So Apache came out, was number one, as you probably know, for 6 weeks. Sold a million records. We were 18. So that's how we met Jerry Lorden, to get back to Jerry, bless him. But he didn't tell us that Burt Whedon had recorded it. He never mentioned Burt Whedon until I think we were number one. And he said, Burt Whedon did record this before. And we said, oh, really? So let's have a listen. And it was very... Yeah, the drum bump, bump, bump. You know, to be fair, you know, when we were arranging it, because the Shadows would arrange between us, how we were going to play it, and we all that intro, you know, Hank wrote down, 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 the introduction, and that's the real thing that grabs you.
Yeah,
the intro and the outro, you go, wow, just very evocative. So we were lucky. We were and suddenly we were away. We weren't just Cliff's backing band.
There were two sort of top.
We had two top acts, if you like, yeah. Two top. You know, we could top the bill
yeah.
as the Shadows. Cliff could certainly top the bill with or without us. You know, with orchestras or anything. So we had this enormous from sort of July 1960. You had two massive acts who chose to work together because we were mates. We were friends. So the Shadows would maybe close the first half of a concert to start with. You know, we'd do maybe 20 minutes doing Shadows instrumentals and then a little interval, and then we'd come back on and back Cliff for half an hour or 35 minutes, whatever it was. So it was a magic formula that we could use all the way through the 60s, you know.
Contiki, Foot Tapper, Dance On, Wonderful Land, Apache, all number one records.
All number ones, yeah, yeah. But we all worked together. But we did get that opportunity to work as the Shadows. This is an incredible story. June 1960, when we just made Apache, to December 1960, 6 months, we were having a season at the Palladium. There was Joan Regan.
Oh, I love Joan.
Edmund Hockridge.
Yes.
David Kossoff and people like that. So we had a slot, you know, the producers of the show, you know, you'd have 15 minutes, you had 20 minutes, 12 minutes, whatever it was. So Cliff and the Shadows had like a 15-minute spot, right? So there were Cliff songs, you know, Living Doll and all the all that stuff, all the massive hits, Move It. And we had the number one single in the country and the producers of the show wouldn't let us play it.
No.
We couldn't play it for 6 months at the Palladium. We had the number one record, sold a million records, and they wouldn't let us add another 3 minutes. You think of it now, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. So a friend of our agent said, I'd like to promote the Shadows concerts by themselves, not with Cliff. We were at the Palladium from, you know, Monday till Saturday. Every Sunday we would go and top the bill as the Shads somewhere, Leicester, and, you know, Newcastle, Bristol. And of course it was always full, you know, it was packed. So that's what I mean. We suddenly had these two top of the bill acts. Cliff was delighted. He was thrilled that his group, you know, his band were massive. You know, we became massive. Cliff was massive anyway. He was the biggest thing since sliced bread, you know, at the time.
It was amazing when you look back then, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic time, yeah.
You see, early on you said Lonnie Donegan influence with his Skiffle.
Yes.
The Shadows also sort of inspired generations of young guys because years ago, a lot of us young guys, we liked the rock and rollers, but we all love the instrumentals, you know, Dwayne Eddy and all these great. So you influenced, you four guys, particularly with the Walk and everything, you influenced generations, didn't you?
We obviously became famous for the Red Stratocasters, you know, the Red Strat, the Pink Strat. Buddy Holly was the first guy we ever saw with a Stratocaster, and we didn't know what it was. You couldn't go in a shop in England and buy one. You couldn't go down, you know, any of the famous streets, you know, Tin Pan Alley, and buy a Stratocaster. So Cliff sent to California to the Fender factory, and we got the brochure. Little brochure came first of all, because Cliff wanted his guitar player, his lead guitarist, to have the best equipment, you know, and sound like an American act, you know, sound like Ricky Nelson and all these people. And I remember it so clearly, this little brochure, you know, it was probably about 6 inches by 4 inches. And we were thumbing through all these guitars that we were playing cheap guitars, you couldn't get them. And we came to the middle of this, you know, came through, and right in the middle of was this pinkish red, gold plated, maple necked Stratocaster, and we went, wow, just look at the photograph, look at it. And Cliff said, we'll get one of those. And he bought it for Hank to play. He imported it into the country. It was about 140 guineas in those days, worth a bit more now. But, you know, Cliff was the only one that had 140 guineas, to be fair. So that became our trademark. I mean, Hank's trademark. Everybody wanted to be Hank. You know, Hank was fantastic. Hank looked like Holly with the glasses, tall, slim, playing a Stratocaster. We all got matching red Stratocasters, and that became the Shadows thing, you know, and so on and so forth. And that was just a magic time, and everybody wanted to play like Hank, everybody, because he was so good.
There's still two of the Rapiers. They're sort of like a Shadows, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of Shadows bands. Yeah. That, you know, I mean, you think of it now at our age, and And everywhere, I know for certain in Canada and some parts of America, Australia, New Zealand, Europe and the UK, every month there are Shadows clubs meeting, still trying to play like Hank, still playing all the hits, all groups get together. I've been to a lot of Shadows clubs, you know, just turn up and have a drink and say hello. And it's a fantastic thing all of this time later. But we were huge influence on groups. I think the group boom came from the Shads, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
I know you sang on some records. Were you happy with that, or would you sooner play instrumentals?
Well, can you remember I said Hank and I were convinced in 1958 we were Don and Phil Everly?
Yes.
Well, when we got to the studio and sing it, you know, a vocal record,
yeah,
and we heard it back, we realised, unfortunately, we weren't Don and Phil. So luckily the instrumentals came along.
But didn't you come second in the Eurovision once?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I wish you wouldn't talk about it.
Oh, sorry.
You are interviewing the only contestant who forgot the words.
Oh, did you?
I forgot part of the first verse. I was so nervous. The head of the BBC said, Billy Cotton Jr., we were in Stockholm because ABBA had won it the year before. He said, 400 million people watching it, guys. He said, try and come second so we don't have to stage it next year, because it costs a fortune.
No.
He poked his head just as we were going on. Anyway, I fluffed a line or a line and a bit in the first verse, but luckily kept going. And I think only the English probably noticed, to be fair, you know.
Yeah.
It's probably a strange accent he was adopting.
Hi, this is Dennis LeCourier, the voice of Dr. Hook, and you're listening to John Hannah Meets on Isle of Wight Radio, because you have such good taste.
Bruce, with the Shadows, you had changes in personnel, but
yes,
the group sort of, all the people you got in were sort of stars in their own right. So
they were,
it didn't affect the group at all, did it?
No, we were. Hank and I were concerned, to be fair, because obviously it was Hank Marvin, Bruce Welch, Chet Harris and Tony Meehan who met in the Two Eyes, like I've mentioned, made the records that made us, you know, famous, for want of a better word. So time went by, not too much time. Chet and Tony. Tony left first. He became late. He was young. He wouldn't get out of bed, basically. We would turn up at the door, you know, going up to Newcastle, an eight-hour drive, and he'd still be in bed. Things like that. And we left him in South Africa once, put the ticket on his bed saying, we're off, you know, we're going home now. And he wouldn't get out of bed. He missed a couple of shows. So Tony left first, quite early on, actually. He left in 1961. So, and because we knew Brian Bennett, Brian was a friend of ours, the first person we asked, you know, was Brian Bennett. And I said, I remember ringing Brian Bennett. And Tony and I and Hank had an argument. We were in Blackpool and he said, oh, I'll get yourself another drummer. You know, one of those sort of young, you do when you're young.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I'll get yourself another drummer. So I rang Brian Bennett the next day. And great little story. I said, shows you the difference in things like now and then. I said, Brian, what are you doing? Where are you? What are you doing? He said, I'm just about to go into the pit as a pit musician, because he could read, read the dots. I think it was the Queen's Theatre. He said, with Tommy Steele. And I said, oh, and I said, how much are you getting with Tommy Steele? Because we were mates, you know. And he said, oh, 25 a week, you know. I said, double it and get up to Blackpool and join the Shadows. And he did.
Yeah.
And he's still here, but we've given him, he's up to 60 quid now.
Yes. I've got all his albums, because he's all the themes he's written.
Oh, fantastic musician, fantastic.
Yeah.
But Hank and I, just to go back to your original question, Hank and I were worried, obviously. I mean, Hank and I were the front men, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
We did the chat and we were doing the singing and all that stuff. And we were obviously concerned, first of all, when Tony left. We were concerned, you know, because it was the original band had made it. But Brian came in, a brilliant drummer, you know, huge asset to us. And then Jet left. Jet was a big name. He was a great player. But bless him, and he's gone now, and, you know, we loved him and everything. But he started to drink. And in those early days, he got a hold of him, you know, and unreliable playing, really. So two of the band went, and we got Licorice Locking, who we'd again met in the Two Eyes, but who played with Brian Bennett in Marty Wilde's Wildcats. Yeah. They were half of Marty Wilde's Wildcats. And Marty was a mate of ours as well. So we took half his band.
Yeah.
So, and we're still, Marty and I are still friends. But so we finished up with two great, replacements, if you like. But we were concerned at the time. But it appeared, as long as sort of Hank and I were there at the front doing the singing and the chat and the jokes and, we got away with it.
I know you gave up for a little while, about 68, was it?
End of 68, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been, Shadows have been 10 years then.
Mm.
And I thought we'd done everything, to be honest. I thought anything a group could do, I thought we'd done. We'd done world tours, we'd made films with Cliff, we'd done TV shows.
Did you like the movies or not? Did you like the movies?
Loved them at the time.
Yeah.
Because I always say music is of a time, but films like that are certainly of their time. Because when you see them now, you go, you sort of cringe a little. But then, 1960 or 61 or 62.
They were brilliant.
They were great films.
Yeah.
Well, not great films. I don't mean great acting or great, it wasn't...
The British musical...
It wasn't Marlon Brando or
no,
anything,
no.
But musically, and they were cute. They were teenage type, young... Like we used to get from America, those Frankie Avalon type movies and all that stuff. But Cliff became a huge movie star 2 years running. Young Ones and Summer Holiday were the box office hits of the year. Because he was acting, so he was on set most of the time. The Shadows would only do, a week. But you'd hang around for 8 weeks. That's because that's the way filming is,
Oh, yeah.
You're in makeup at 7 in the morning and then they call you at 5 to 5.
You wrote some of the songs too, didn't you?
Hank and I wrote something in The Young Ones. I think it was Got a Funny Feeling, I think Hank and I wrote in The Young Ones.
But you wrote Summer
and
Holiday.
And we say, yeah.
Yeah.
That's The Young Ones.
Yeah.
But then Brian Bennett and I wrote Summer Holiday.
Wow. Everybody knows that song, don't they?
Yeah, it's a bit like the summer White Christmas.
Yes.
It's become that. But Bachelor Boy and all that stuff were in... And Foot Tapper was in Summer Holiday.
Yeah.
So we had three, four number ones from Summer Holiday in 1963.
And I know you produced people later on. Well, you produced Cliff, Olivia Newton-John, yep. Cilla, Roger Whittaker.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. It was a natural progression for me. I loved songs. I loved songwriters. I loved songs. I loved really good songs. I couldn't write them myself. Bachelor Boy is not exactly a song of the year, but it was a massive hit. Sold a million records again at the time.
Telling me.
But I loved songs. I started producing with Olivia, who was my fiancée at the time, as you probably know. And we had a band called Marvin Welsh and Farrah, John Farrah, we brought from Australia. And our manager, Peter Gormley, said, we want to record Olivia, So we'd like you and John to, produce Olivia. So, again, we looked for songs, and the first hit was If Not For You.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah, If Not For You. And Banks of the Ohio, and I think What Is Life and stuff. Yeah, so that's where record production started, really. And then, jump on another 3 or 4 years. And in 1975 or 1976, again, Cliff's manager said, anyone who comes up with some great songs... will have the opportunity to produce Cliff. So all my friends were songwriters. I knew all the top songwriters. I went looking for songs. And I found three songs at first. Took them to Peter Gormley, our manager. And I said, what do you think of these, Peter? And I played him Miss Unites, Devil Woman, and a song called I Can't Ask For Any More Than You. And he went, whoa, great. He said, go and play them to Cliff. So Cliff lived out in Weybridge at the time. Went out there with the three songs, and we're in his studio above his garage. And great to see him. And I said, can I just play these three songs? And I put Miss Unites on, and the hair stood up on his arms, on the back of his neck, everything. He went, oh, I've just got to do this song. And then I played Devil Woman, and this other one, I Can't Ask For Any More Than You. And he said, great. He said, let's record all of them. So, cut a long story short, we recorded the three songs, And suddenly everybody was jumping up and down. EMI said, and the manager, and Cliff himself said, oh, we've got to make, it's not just three. He said, let's make it an album.
What an album.
So that turned into I'm Nearly Famous.
Yeah.
In 1976, I think. We had all the songs. And that album and the hits from it brought Cliff back in a big way in the charts. People couldn't believe it was Cliff singing Devil Woman with a falsetto and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But the quality of a song like Misunites, just, it's electrifying. Mm. It does make it, you know, when you hear it for the first time, and everyone's been in those love situations where you've lost your love or you want your love, you know, that incredible lyric of Misunites. And Cliff does a great performance on all of it. And suddenly we had everyone in 1976 walking around with, you know, promotion, I'm Nearly Famous T-shirts.
Yeah.
Elton was wearing one. Elizabeth Taylor was wearing one. All the top stars were wearing I'm Nearly Famous. So it brought him back in a great way. So that was fantastic production. I did three albums, I think. What did I say then? Fantastic production. That's a bit
over
the top.
I
made a fantastic
said that.
Success. That's the word I was thinking of. And I did three albums. Then Cliff and Terry produced their own album. Cliff, Terry Britton, by the way, who'd written Devil Woman. And then Alan Tarney, who was my friend, who was Cliff's bass player, who played on the sessions, in the I'm Nearly Famous sessions, brought me a song. And he said, can I play you this new song, Bruce? And I said, yeah. And he put on a cassette that he played and sang all the instruments, played it and sang it, and it was We Don't Talk Anymore. And I went, wow, this is... So even though they were just finishing off their album, I rushed to Peter Gormley and I said, Peter, listen to this. I said, this is a world hit. This is a smash. And he said, I think you're right. He said, go and play it to Cliff. And we recorded it, and EMI were jumping up and down. Oh, fantastic. This is great. It's got to be on Cliff's new album. And at the time, to be fair, Cliff and Terry were a bit miffed because they said, well, no, this is our album. And this is all. We produced it. And EMI said, this record has to go on this album. And they released the single, released the album. It turned out We Don't Talk Anymore sold 5 million singles. Biggest hit of his career. So... I've been lucky, but I've worked with talent. You know, when you work with great, Cliff's a great singer. He's a great singer, you know, great talent. So it's been very thrilling to have been involved, not just as a player or a songwriter or in his band, but to make hit records as a producer with friends of yours.
Ooh, I could crush a grape. I could test drive a Tonka. If it isn't John Hannum Meets.
Currently, I'm at the Electric Airwave studio in London with Bruce Welch, and we are in a soundproof studio, but outside there's a pretty noisy pneumatic drill which has joined us, I think.
I think that's Shadows fans trying to get in, to be honest. They'll do anything to get in. You know?
Yes, they will. So when you reformed the Shadows, was that for money or not?
No. Well, it was everything. If you think about it, we did Eurovision. We came second, as you know. But we were in the top 10 with Let Me Be The One. And The Shadows hadn't had a top 10 single in about, I don't know, 8, 9 years maybe. So EMI, to be fair, called us in and said, you've got a hit record, you know, all the back catalogue still sells. We know you've got Marvin Welsh and Farrah, you know, we've done that. And it wasn't the hit you thought maybe it would be, hopefully it would be. So you'd be mad not to follow this up, to be fair. So we all agreed and we said, why don't we do half a dozen concerts? So we did half a dozen concerts in the usual Bristol and Leicester and all sold out. We hadn't been the Shadows for quite a while. You know, we'd done them. And I remember playing Croydon and we just came on because we did the whole show then in those days. And all the audience stood up. We hadn't played anything. It was just to see us back together, I think. And that warmth was just tremendous. We did the concerts, fantastic, we loved it. You get the bug back playing and all the hits and all that stuff. And EMI said, again, bless them, this was going into January of 1977, they said, we're going to release an album on television called The Shadows 20 Golden Greats. And we went, oh, great. Well, all the old stuff, you know, all the mono and all that Apache and all the early stuff. He said, yeah. We've got 20 golden greats with the famous cover with the three guitars.
Yeah.
So out it came. And this is the winter of 77. And it sold 1.25 million albums in the UK. And we said, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's like... So management, we all said, yeah, let's do a tour. So we did The Shadows' 20 Golden Dates. Again, sold out. Everywhere was sold. The reception was amazing. And that just kept us going. We never stopped after that. We were back. So from 77, we reformed properly, you know, and touring and all that stuff, making other albums. And we couldn't believe that all our old stuff, which so many of the public probably had before, you know. They bought again, yeah. That was the power of TV advertising. That's when TV advertising albums by the Beach Boys or Dinah Ross or whoever, you know, that came to the fore in the 70s. You know.
Bruce, you had 14 years between top 10 hits, I think.
Did we?
Yeah. When you
You're a mine of useless information,
yeah, I
John.
Know. I'm sorry about that. So, looking back, you've had an amazing career. Did you actually act as a musical advisor for Buddy, the stage?
I did, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to use that word fortuitous again. Yeah. It's not easy to say that.
No, it isn't.
When you're only drinking tea in the morning.
Yeah.
But I lived in Walton-on-Thames at the time. I'm talking 80s now, probably halfway through the 80s, maybe a bit later. And I'm waiting with a friend of mine, Roger Greenaway, who was a fantastic songwriter, on the platform to go into London, which is like 16 minutes or 20 minutes into London on the train. So we get in, and this gentleman got in, and Roger said, oh, Laurie, he said, do you know Bruce Welch? I said, no, hi, Laurie. And Laurie was a famous entrepreneur. We got talking, and he said, you and Hank were great Buddy Holly fans, weren't you? I said, well, were we?
Yeah.
You know, I said, Hank, you know, with the glasses and the Stratocaster. We all bought Stratocasters because of Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
He said, would you be interested, Bruce? I'm going to put on a musical of Buddy's life on stage. Would you care to help? Would you be musical associate? You know, you could, because would you know about how it all happened, how he recorded, what he did, how he played it? I said, yeah.
Yeah.
I know it all backwards, really. And he said, well, I'd like you to do it if you'd be interested. So I became the musical consultant, was the correct word. I feel like a doctor, a consultant. And we went looking for Buddy Holly's and the show. And cut a long story short, we got about 7 possible Buddy Holly's, guys who would put the glasses on. And Laurie went to the Albert Hall one night to see Carole King. And Carole King's guitarist looked like Buddy Holly. It was fantastic. Tall, slim, curly hair. And... he became Buddy Holly. And so we opened in Plymouth. We did a 3-week tryout in Plymouth. And the reaction the first night was the same as the reaction 13 years later, because we ran in the West End for 13 years. Yeah. It was a phenomenal show. And because the people loved his music. They still love his music. Those songs he wrote and sang.
Tell
you know, they played on the radio all of the time.
Yeah.
And anybody in a band... who's been in a group as a guitar player, everybody's played Buddy Holly songs. You know, the Beatles' little first ever demo they made was That'll Be the Day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know you're still playing, because when I saw Duane Eddy a few weeks ago in London...
Duane who?
You came on stage and played. It was terrific. I bet that was a kick for you, wasn't it?
It was. The kick was only 24 hours before. I got an email. I think Duane played on them Tuesday night or whatever it was. And I got an email on the Monday saying, well, Duane would be thrilled if you would come and play Shazam.
Yeah.
And in bracket, in the key of us, is there any other key for Shazam? And I went, ooh, getting up with Duane. You know, I haven't seen him for 20 years or whatever it was. And anyway, cut a long story short, I came the next day and met your good self in the stalls, stood there, and I thought, wow. And I'm standing there. Two things. Duane Eddy, in September 58, started the whole guitar instrumental boom. If it hadn't been for Duane, with Rebel Rouser and all those fantastic hits he had, maybe there wouldn't have been a Shadows instrumental thing, or the Ventures as well, you know, who came in 1960. So the day I met you there was twofold for me. First of all, going on the stage and saying hello again, meeting him, doing the 2 minutes, because they hired a Fender for me, and I said, I'll just plug into somebody's amp, you know, Richard Hawley's amp. And we did Shazam, as you know.
Yes.
So that was my 2 minutes of fame playing with Dwayne. And I always thought it was great. I said, I'm a bit of a perfectionist myself. And we did it, and it's 2 minutes long. And he said, great, great, great. I said, no, can we do it again, Dwayne? He said, why? I said, I just like to play it more than once. You know, it's only 2 minutes long. So I'd just like to get a bit closer to the drummer and hear the bottom end and all that stuff. We did it twice, rehearsal twice. And I stood there during, while I was playing that 2 minutes, and I was looking up, you know, it's a fantastic theatre, the Palladium. And I thought, my God, the times we've played here, you know, probably hundreds of times over the last 60 years because of, like, the six-month season, four-month seasons of, you know, Aladdin and Cinderella and the 20th anniversary season and this Marvin Welsh and Farrell, oh, you know, working there with Tom Jones, been there many times, and the TV shows, of course, all the TV shows. And it was just a thrill to be back, even if it was for 2 minutes, on the Palladium stage, but to work with one of your heroes who was, sometimes when you meet your heroes, you get disappointed. But he was a gentleman, he was lovely. I think he said something like, evidently he'd ask someone, a friend of mine, do you think Bruce would be upset? He said, and I think he introduced me saying, this man has spent his life in the shadows, but I'd like to bring him out of the shadows tonight.
Yeah, that was very clever.
To back me on Shazam. And I loved it. I loved it. And he's a lovely man, a lovely guy. His wife was lovely, very, very, you know, welcoming. So I felt quite at home, even if it was for 2 minutes.
And Bob Harris was there. Conway
Bob,
was...
yep.
Great day, wasn't
Whispering
it?
Whispering Bob.
Yes. You got an OBE as well. Congrats on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was thrilled a bit. To be fair, the Shadows were all offered one, Hank, myself and Brian Bennett, in 2004 for our services to music. I always put question mark at the end of that. But yeah, for our services to music. I think because of the influence we had, you know, on so many groups and people, especially guitar players. But also there'd been no... you know, no scandals, no, you know, we hadn't dealt our income tax or hadn't been in jail for something else. So it was a very great honour. Hank, because of his religion, turned it down, a Jehovah's Witness. So he didn't feel as though he could accept it, which is fine. But Brian Bennett and I went there and met the Queen. She did the two of us together. We'd met her quite a few times before doing the Royal Variety shows and things like that. And she said, and how long have you been going now? And I said, almost as long as you have, Aww. Your Majesty. And she smiled, and she looked to both of us, and she said, and never a cross word. And I said, we can't say that. She was brilliant. She was great. But we were thrilled a bit. It's a great honour, you know.
I wonder how much a record called Please, Mr. Please would be now, if you could find one. That was your solo
record. Yeah.
Is that still around? Was there many sold or not really?
No, it wasn't a hit at all.
Have you got a copy or not?
I don't think I have.
Oh, have you?
I've got the other version.
Yes.
Well, Please, Mr. Please, not many people know about that, but Please, Mr. Please, Olivia and I split up in the early 70s. And I was writing with John Rostill, who was the Shadows bass player, another great talent, another great bass player, but great talent. And we were writing songs, and we wrote this song called Please, Mr. Please. And you wouldn't have to be too clever to look at the lyric and realise what it was about. And so I thought, John said, oh, you should record that, mate. You should do it. I said, anyway, I took it to EMI. They liked the song. I recorded it totally. It was like this must have been about 1973 or 4 even, maybe. No, 73. So I did a totally different up-tempo, this, that and the other. Anyway, it sunk without trace, but it was a good song. Still a good song. I didn't think anything of it for months and months. And then John Farrar, who had moved to America with Olivia and producing her, sent me over. He said, I'd like you to listen to this little tune of yours, Bruce, that we recorded. And it was Please, Mr. Please, Olivia's version, which went to number one in America, sold a million copies. And I said, thanks, John. Yeah, it was lovely. Totally just, different version.
Oh, yeah.
She was the queen of America, middle America, you know, with her country music type stuff. Brilliant.
Bruce, right away from music, what do you do? What's your big turn off?
Turn off?
Yeah, when you're not playing
listening
music.
To Shadows records.
Yeah.
Turn on, you mean?
Yeah, all right.
My turn on,
yeah.
I love, John, I love history. Even when I was at school, I loved history. I loved archaeology. I loved stuff like that. Could never do anything about it, but one of my great passions is ancient Roman history.
Is it?
The Romans, the you know, what they
did. They landed on the Isle of Wight, do you know that?
They built a wall in Newcastle, mate.
Yeah.
Hadrian's, oh, yes, they did, Hadrian's yeah. Wall. That's yeah. to keep the Scots out.
Yeah.
So, never having had time during my long career to have time to go and look at all these things the Romans did, I do that now, and I've done it for quite a few years now. And so I go to Rome, I go to North Africa, I go to the Amalfi Coast. I love all the old emperors. I just love the history of it. And it's the old joke, you know, in this country, they say, what did the Romans ever do for us, you know? Straight roads, central heating, Hadrian's Wall, you know, half the buildings are still here. I just love that part of history, you know. So that's my main, not turn on, it doesn't sound right now, does it? I just love doing that. And my other, which is probably, sounds a bit strange, but isn't, I love the history of the Second World War. Obviously, I'm a war baby. I was born in the war. My father was in the Royal Artillery. And obviously, like the Roman stuff, you can go and visit these places where incredible heroism and tragedy also happened. You know, you can just drive into Europe and there it is. So I find that fascinating, the tragedy of war. But then I'm the first on my feet on, you know, November the 11th, when the 2 minute silence. I love all that stuff. So Roman history and the Second World War takes up a fair amount of my time.
Bruce, it's been an absolute pleasure to come up and chat to you, because I've waited a long time, and through Dwayne Eddy, we're together today, which is
terrific.
We're
together. Isn't that great?
And so, you still play when you can, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, we don't tour now. The Shads won't tour. Hank won't come now. You know, he lives in Perth in Australia, as you know. He's been there since 1986, so he's an Aussie now.
Yes.
He's an Aussie. When the English cricket team goes there, he bats for Australia.
No.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He's an Aussie now. But to be fair, you know, when Cliff and the Shads did that last tour, the final tour, I know the Shads have done three, but
yeah,
that reunion tour and the final, it was the final 50 years. It was a magic time to be back with Cliff and the Shads playing Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Europe, the UK. The receptions we got were heartwarming, just heartwarming, you know, and we filled 56 arenas around the world. It was just, what a way to go out.
Yes.
Well, we couldn't really top that.
Masses of hair you still got. I'm very envious, Bruce Welch.
Well, I've got a spare one. I've got two of these.
Have you?
No, I know it's
yours. Don't worry.
No, it's mine. Yeah, yeah.
Not all our British rock and rollers have got their own,
but we won't go down that road. No.
Can I once again say thanks a lot, and I wish you great, good health in the future, Bruce, thank really.
That's the main thing, John. And good to meet you properly. And I hope you get 2 or 3 minutes out of this interview.
I'm sure I will. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks a lot.
In fact, I got more than just a few minutes. Today, you've been listening to part 2 of the Bruce Welch, or Bruce Welsh, whichever you prefer, interview. So instead of a few minutes, in the end, I got 70 minutes. Grateful thanks to him. You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.